QSO Today, episode 485, Martin Buhring, KB4MG. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. Sadly, there were no new donations and listener sponsors this week. My puppy weeps from looking at her empty bowl. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. I continue to make blog posts about the war in Israel. Please click on the blog menu item to read my weekly thoughts on the matter. Martin, Marty, Buhring, KB4MG, discovered amateur radio in private high school, growing up in Chicago, Illinois, and went on for a career in electronics engineering, following the development of semiconductors, from basic transistors to large-scale integrated circuits and ASICs. Marty believes that ham radio clubs are key to ham radio success. KB4MG is my QSO today. KB4MG, this is Eric 4Z1UG. Are you there, Martin?
I am, Eric, KB4MG. I got you 5'9 here in Atlanta, Georgia, Eric.
Well, thanks, Martin. I have you 5'9 here in Efrat, Israel. It's a beautiful winter day here. I want to thank you for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, I think like many of your other guests, Eric, I think I can trace my roots of ham radio all the way back to my childhood because as a child, I was always very interested in electricity. I had an uncle who was really a great uncle. I called him uncle, but he was really a great uncle. And he used to come to the house and help my father do repairs. And a lot of times those involved maybe rewiring something or fixing switches or what have you around the house. And I would always patiently ask him, you know, what are you doing? And he would patiently explain. And so that kind of piqued my interest as a child. And it led me to just doodling around with wires and batteries and switches and low voltage light bulbs, nothing, you know, plugged into the wall. And so it just kind of piqued my interest.
What was your hometown?
Oh, it was Chicago.
Oh, Chicago.
Yeah.
In the city.
Yeah, in the city and in the south side of the city.
And that was a time, I'm assuming, that this was 50s, 60s.
Yes.
And people fixed things.
They did. They fixed everything back then. My father was not very good with tools and certainly didn't want to touch anything that had to do with electricity. So it was always up to my great uncle to come over and do these repairs.
Now, was he involved in radio at all?
No, he wasn't, but he seemed to be a jack of all trades. He was interested in a lot of different things, which is what piqued my interest, too. He was actually a very good carpenter. He could do electrical work. He could do plumbing. There was hardly anything he couldn't do. But in his profession, he was actually an accountant, which was really funny.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
You'd think it's different hemispheres of the brain to be able to do accounting.
Right.
And do troubleshooting or fixing or something like that.
Yeah. So I don't know where he got his skills and where he, I was too young really to probably ask those questions and understand. But, you know, he must have gotten them maybe from a grandfather or a father, gotten some of those skills. But as you said, back then, everybody fixed everything. And I think he just tried whatever it was, he would try to fix it.
Now, I got a sense from your QRZ page that you actually went to private school in Chicago.
I did. I attended St. Rita High School, also in the city of Chicago. It was a great school. It really was. And, you know, it was especially good for me because it not only provided the discipline that I think you need oftentimes as a teenager, but it also gave me the opportunity to connect with a priest there who was very interested in electronics and had an amateur radio license.
Oh, really? So that's the genesis of your ham radio interest came from this priest at school.
That's correct. His name was Father Casimir Pizarro, and he taught different subjects in school, but after school, he would teach electronics and amateur radio to anybody that wanted to come. I was there almost every day. After school, I was, you know, in the electronics lab with Father Pizarro, and he was teaching us electronics. We were hooking things together. A lot of things back then were vacuum tube, but we had some transistors and other things to play with, and we had a fantastic amateur radio station.
Well, I see from the picture that's on your QRZ page that you guys were wearing coat and ties. Was that the standard uniform?
That was the standard uniform back then, and in fact, it was required to wear a coat and tie to school, and the color of the tie indicated the class level or grade level that you were in. So if you had a red tie, you were a freshman, and so forth, and the seniors had black ties. So you knew by the color of the tie.
And are you giving away secrets? I mean, I'm assuming the students quickly learned that this is how the hierarchy works.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, because certainly the red tie guys were the ones that, you know, that the seniors would pick on a little bit.
So what happened? You got your ham radio license in high school?
I did. So, you know, I studied for the exam and learned really electronics from this priest, and took the novice exam and was able to earn my novice license back in 1966, call sign WN9WEX. Yeah, it was great. And I was so interested in the club, and I think that people realized that I had a commitment to learning more and really wanting to be a bit part of the club, that I became the secretary of the club the following year. So that's what you see in the picture that was on my QRZ page, is me sitting at the radio. I was the club secretary, and that was the picture that was posted in the yearbook for the radio club.
Now, did you have a station at home?
I did. I had a really modest station at home. I know it was a Heathkit, and I don't remember the model number, but it was the one that was crystal controlled, and it was about 50 watts. And then as my receiver, I had received this was a little bit earlier, I had actually received a Helicrafters SX-118 as a shortwave radio as a graduation gift from grade school. And I had been kind of actively listening to shortwave stations as well as hams. And so that also kind of plays back into the roots of my amateur radio, actually starting to listen to hams on the air, not knowing really a lot about what they were doing and what they were saying, but very interested in what was going on.
Did you collect QSL cards from international broadcasters?
I did get a few, yes. I did mail away for a few of those and got a very few. But, yeah, that wasn't the thrust of what I was doing. I did enjoy listening to the shortwave stations, though, but I wasn't as serious, I think, about shortwave as collecting gobs of QSL cards.
Did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your education and career then?
Well, absolutely, because when I, in my last year of high school, we actually moved. So my last year of high school involved a move to another suburb outside of Chicago, and they had a great public school there. So my last year of high school, I actually went to a public school. And about a block away from the high school, I noticed that there was a television radio shop. I went in there one day and I said to the guy, hey, you know, you're looking for any help. And he goes, well, I don't know. What can you do? And I said, well, I have an amateur radio license. I know some stuff about electronics. And, you know, if you need some help on Saturdays and so forth, I'd be interested in the job. And sure enough, he hired me. And I would come in on Saturdays and I would fix a lot of the small electronics, you know, radios and phonographs and other things for him. And that kind of gave me a start, I think, as a career in electronics. And I thought, this is really great. And, you know, this is really what I want to do. I want to learn electronics, but I want to do engineering. I want to learn how to design this. I don't want to learn how to just fix it. I want to know how to design this.
And so where did you go after high school?
After high school, I went to the University of Illinois in Chicago and started my education there as an electrical engineer. I went there for 2 years, ran out of money, and found, though, that I could get a full tuition scholarship at Southern Illinois University down in Carbondale, Illinois. Because the reason is that they were in the process, really, of growing their engineering department. They had a kind of a fledgling engineering department, but they were wanting to attract a lot more students, and they were especially interested in students coming from University of Illinois, who has a very well-respected engineering program. So I actually changed schools, went down to University of Illinois, from University of Illinois down to Southern Illinois University, and got a job working for the university fixing the laboratory equipment, because I had this knowledge of fixing things and repairing TVs, repairing radios, all of this. They needed a person to help fix voltmeters, oscilloscopes, generators, all these things. So I got a job at the university fixing all that.
That actually was how I paid for my college, too, was I could fix things.
It was great because, you know, the hours were flexible, and they knew I was taking classes. So whenever I had a break in a schedule or something, I would go to the electronics department and fix a couple of things and then go back, take my other classes.
And where was Carbondale?
It's in Southern Illinois. It is down at the very southern tip of Illinois, but it's a little bit to the south and east of St. Louis, Missouri. So it's actually down in the area where Bob Heil lived, right?
Is it down near Centralia?
Yes, but further south.
But further south.
It was a great place. It's a nice school, nice campus, and what I enjoyed most about it, honestly, Eric, was the fact that the engineering department was not so big, and it really gave me the chance to interact more with the professors, to have more opportunity, really, to do things that I wouldn't normally be able to maybe do in a large university where there's so many students and so much competition.
Were the labs better? Was it maybe more hands-on?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There was a lot more hands-on, I think, than what you would have at a large university, because you got a smaller number of students. So it's easier. You got a more interaction with the teachers, professors, and the people that teach the labs. All of that. Being smaller is always better, I think.
Did you have a amateur radio club there?
We did not, which was interesting, because that's where my pause in amateur radio kind of happens here, is that we did not have an amateur radio club. I was a little disappointed in that. But, you know, at that point, I was really too busy. I spent most of my time in the engineering lab or in the computer center. And, you know, I had just about enough time to do all of that. And I don't know if I'd had a lot of time to do a lot with amateur radio. So it kind of got put on the shelf there for many years.
So what happened after when you graduated? What did you end up doing? Where'd you go?
Well, coming out of school in the 70s, I graduated, I think, in 74. We were kind of in a recession at that point. Jobs were a little tight. But coming from my hometown of Chicago, one of the ones who did hire there, and they like to hire a lot of new people out of college, was the Motorola Corporation. So I went to work for Motorola in a rotational program, and that's where I started my career. They started me actually not in engineering, interestingly enough, but in technical marketing. So it was a rotation program where you spend a little time in a number of different disciplines, and then they pick what they think you're best suited for.
What was the product line that you were technically marketing?
Well, the product line that they had there was pretty interesting, because it was a lot of different miscellaneous products. This particular group of Motorola was called Data Products, and it doesn't exist anymore. It was absorbed, I think, into the communications group at one point. But we did a lot of work on products that were at the time using microprocessors. So these were one of the products that I helped market, and then I eventually helped engineer were early systems for flight information display in the airports. So if you remember way back when the airports had, you'd see the boards up in the airport, and it had all these mechanical things that would flip all the numbers and flights. And, and they eventually all got replaced, right, with TV tubes, right, with CRTs. And Motorola was one of the first people to engineer one of these systems to replace those mechanical systems with the flight information display that you see on the TV screens. And so that was a business that we were involved in. And I was involved in the technical marketing part of that, but then became part of the engineering team that was developing the product.
Just out of curiosity, they were using some kind of like serial or RS-485 or something like that?
Exactly. And in ones that were a distance away, we actually used modems because, you know, it was too far a distance for just RS-488. So yeah, we would use modems to talk to some of the remote ones. And then we effectively have another microcontroller or microprocessor based systems there that would have the modem and have all the hardware necessary to generate the video.
So the box was RS-485 in and video out?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I remember those days when there were all these square television screens stacked two high, three high, six across, something like that.
It was an interesting business. You know, we made a couple of other small products and projects as well. And then we were one of the few divisions of Motorola that was actually doing applications of microprocessors. If you remember back then, they had the 6800, the 6809, eventually the 68000, but this was even before 68000 days. They were looking for ways to design microprocessors into products. And at that time, the communications group was not doing that. None of the radios had microprocessors in them. So eventually we introduced some of that stuff to some of the engineering teams, and they started incorporating microprocessors into their products as well.
Well, I think it was perhaps the late 70s when they started putting it in their MODAT.
Right.
Telemetry from police cars.
Yes, exactly. That was about the time I left Motorola, was when all that was starting to happen, and kind of even the early stages of cellular, right, were beginning but at that point.
Then where did you go from there?
My interests were in microprocessors and embedded systems and all that kind of thing. And I got a job offer to go to work as a field application engineer with Signetics Philips. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. This is going to put me out of my comfort zone for sure, because now I'm going to have contact with customers. But I'm going to get to see a lot of different things. And a lot of these customers are struggling with trying to figure out how to build systems around microprocessors, which was the big thing of the day. And I thought this would be a great opportunity. So I went to work for Signetics Philips. You know, it was really a skill building time for me, learning how to work in diverse and sometimes difficult situations, difficult customers, new products being thrown at us all the time. And I was there for a number of years. I think I was there maybe about 5 years, roughly.
So your territory was North America?
It was actually based out of Chicago. Believe it or not, we had about maybe six or eight states, I think, in our territory. But the sales manager who was in charge of that territory also had all of Canada. Which was kind of crazy because we couldn't really cover all of Canada, but we would cover, you know, the at least the metro areas up in Toronto and Ottawa. And that's where a lot of the customers were anyway. And that's where you had people like Nortel, right, and some other large customers up in those areas. So we had that as a territory. I used to travel up there pretty regularly.
What were the kinds of products that were being built? If you were talking Nortel, you were talking about telephone switches, things like that.
Exactly. So a lot of the products that we had were what we would call kind of, just generic stuff. There was a whole, as you say, there was a big, big catalog of TTL and all these types of logic things that really didn't require much of my time or application engineer's time. The products that we would spend the most time on were newer products that were coming out. And this was really kind of the genesis of the programmable logic phase. And Signetics was one of the early ones in the programmable logic market.
So there's large scale integration then.
Yes.
And they were calling them LSI.
Yep. So we had these field programmable gate arrays, things that we were helping customers to design into their systems, which which was challenging because this was new technology. They had to learn new things. They had to learn how to program these things. And it was a challenging time for them to make that transition.
Plus, I think the computer industry was blowing up like nuclear, right? And that there's a need for modem chips. And as I recall this whole period of time, we were going from 2400 baud to 19.9 or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
What is EDA, electronic design automation? I see that that's connected to something that you had a very big interest in.
Yes, because that's where I really moved my career next, because interestingly, while I was at Signetics Philips, this is when kind of the explosion happened of what we would call ASIC technology, application-specific integrated circuits. And these are circuits that are designed that are application-specific, like the name implies. And so you're as a customer, you design these schematics of what this chip is going to do, and then we manufacture that for you. So I ran a design center based out of Chicago where we would take these designs in and then we would prepare them for the back-end processing to be done in the factory back in Sunnyvale, California, so that we would actually make custom chips then for customers that that needed that type of technology. So that gave me the introduction to this EDA stuff, because I had to use these EDA or electronic design automation tools to help to do this process, right? And so that really piqued my interest in a lot of that. I could see that that was an up-and-coming thing. There was a company called Mentor Graphics, who was an early one in that space, and that's the tools we were using in our design center was Mentor Graphics. It was a company that was founded somewhere in the 1981 timeframe, and that was their primary purpose, was to create graphic automation tools for designing, you know, integrated circuits.
And how long did that carry you? Did that carry you through the rest of your career?
That carried me through the rest of my career, because when I left Signetics and went to work for Mentor Graphics, it was a 33-year career. I did a lot of different things at Mentor. I supported, you know, different products like functional, you know, simulation, hardware, software, co-simulation. I did logic synthesis. And then for the last number of years of my career there, I did design for test, which turns out to be one of the more important things today in designing the integrated circuits, because if you can't test them, you can't sell them.
Are you talking about building testers off the line?
This is really things that you need to build into the chip to allow it to be tested, Eric. So the problem with chips is that they're so complicated, you could not functionally test them anymore. And that's what a lot of people don't realize, is that chips are no longer functionally tested. They're tested using something called scan technology, where we turn all of the flip-flops into shift registers and we scan patterns through there and try to determine whether or not there are any issues or problems in the chip. So it's a technology that's been around for quite a long time, but it's gotten incredibly complex over time. And now it's to the point where when I left the company, we were building literally networks on the chips, tying together all of these design for test blocks in order to test these incredibly large chips that have a billion transistors in them. And guess what? All the billion transistors have to work or the chip's no good.
And now this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener-sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors to influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer, we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcast coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. What does the yields look like? Now, have we gotten pretty good in the world at making chips that you're not throwing 30% of them in the trash?
They've gotten incredibly good. When they come along with a new technology, though, there's always a hiccup in there for a while because they're still getting the process technology kind of worked out. Once they get to that point, the yields are fairly high, and most of the fabs, by the way, do keep that stuff as proprietary information. They won't even tell you sometimes, you know, what the yield is, but customers usually know because they know about how many wafers starts there are going through the fab. They know about how many chips are getting delivered to them, so they can probably come up with some rough numbers, but it's somewhere in the 80% range, Eric, of good chips from a wafer, and it can be as high as in the 90s for things of lower complexity.
I actually have never been in a chip fab. At some point, maybe I should go.
Absolutely, it's fascinating.
Intel's spending another $20 billion here in Israel to add on to the fab that they have. 45 minutes from here, I should go down and take a look.
I agree. Yeah, it's an education for sure, and I think it's something that most people take for granted now. I mean, we have chips in literally everything from coffee pots to the cell phones to cars. And, you know, it's in everything, right? But it's all ubiquitous to us. It's we just don't even know it's there anymore.
Right, but we don't appreciate that these fabrication plants are billions of dollars.
Yes.
I think there's two $4 billion fabs here in Israel right now. And they're talking about spending another $20 billion. Either the price has gone up or they're significantly doubling the operation.
Well, they're increasing the capacity, and they've been doing that for a while too. But what makes the cost so high is that to build these smaller and smaller technologies is requiring more and more expensive equipment. So the equipment costs alone, can be in the hundreds of millions of dollars for some of these machines. You can imagine the companies that make these machines don't make tons of these either. So they're making incredibly sophisticated machines that, you know, you may only sell a couple of hundred of them, but they're so complex that the cost of these machines is huge.
Is there a market, a used market, for machines that had older fab technology?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think there are some more of those fabs in Europe. There are still some here in the United States that are building what you would think would be old technology. But there's reasons for some of that. Some of it is because you still have a market for lower complexity parts. There's still a market for replacement parts. And there are still a lot of products out there that don't require the state-of-the-art fabrication facilities to build. And in fact, it probably is kind of foolish to use that state of the art for building a product that, you know, here's a perfect example. You might think of something like a Raspberry Pi.
Right.
It's a fairly complex design anyway, but does it need, 3-micron technology? Does it? I mean, 3 nanometer technology. It needs, you know, maybe 25 nanometer technology, not 3. Okay, so you can build it on processes that are maybe not as sophisticated, and that keeps the cost lower.
3 nanometer technology would be, say, more advanced cell phones, for example.
That's exactly right, and that's I think that's pretty much the technology node they're at now for what Apple is building in cell phones and so forth. It's 3 nanometer, but I know that the fabs now are playing with 1 nanometer. We keep thinking that we've gotten to the end of it in terms of our ability to make things that small and be able to test things that small and everything, but it seems like the engineers and the scientists just figure out another way.
Right. Next system will be you'll have a biological chip in your smartphone.
Never know.
A smartphone that talks back to you.
We are getting to the end of the physics, at least for silicon. So yeah, they're going to have to think of something new.
So when did you get back into ham radio?
I got an interest again back in about 2013. And, you know, I'm not even sure what sparked it other than the fact that I thought, you know, it would be nice to get back into that hobby again. I'm getting closer to retirement, but, you know, there's also a lot of concern in the world these days about, you know, if infrastructure goes down and so forth, could you even communicate? And it kind of sparked my interest again to look into it. And I thought, well, I'm just gonna go to find the local club. I'm gonna go to a meeting, right, and see what's going on. And probably like you and maybe a lot of other folks, I went to the meeting and I was actually not that impressed. There was a lot of business meeting part of it, a lot of chit chat, and there was no technical program. So I almost gave up right there. But then I said, no, I think there's more to this. And started talking with some of the folks that were in the club and, you know, understanding maybe at least what they do on a personal basis. And that at least gave me the impetus to come back and say, look, I'm just going to get the license anyway. Let me see what I can do with this. And so I did. Back in 2013, I passed the technician. I took the technician class again and the general and passed both of those the same day. And then it was a year later, I took my amateur extra license and passed that with no trouble. So since then, I'd been very active, obviously, and I've been the person who really wanted to see this club succeed. So I really kind of dug in and tried to be a good member of the club, tried to, you know, be involved in whatever activities, field day, whatever they were doing. And tried my best to help this club.
As many people might recall, you did a program with Dave Jensen, W7DGJ, about becoming a magnet club for newcomers. I'm assuming that was based on yours and Dave's experience with ham radio clubs, at least in the past, and how they could be in the future. How's that going? Maybe you could talk a little bit about what that was about. What is a magnet club? What does it take to become a magnet club? And then kind of update us on how it's going. And I'll put a link to that presentation in the show notes page.
That'd be great, Eric. Yeah. Well, you know, it started because the club, as I became more active in the club and then finally actually became the president of the club, I started to change things around. We had about 20 members in the club. And over a span of 6 years, we've grown to 130. So those are pretty impressive growth results. And I can't take credit for all of that, but I can take some credit for the fact that I think I plus some other people in the club who really wanted to see the club get better and succeed, you know, really dug in and started to figure out what is it that is going to take to make this club really be better and to make it grow. And because I really still believe that the clubs are the backbone really of this hobby. And I'm, you know, concerned about the health of the clubs in the United States and was concerned about the health of this club and really wanted to see it grow.
Could you say what club that you're talking about?
Yeah, the club I belong to and the club that we have built up over time is the Cherokee Amateur Radio Society, and we're in Woodstock, Georgia.
Which is a suburb of Atlanta?
Suburb of Atlanta.
How many amateur radio clubs are in the Atlanta area?
I think there are about five or six, depending upon how far out you want to go, of course. But there is a fairly large club that is in the largest county in the Atlanta area. That's Fulton County, which is the county which the city of Atlanta is in. So there's really a couple of clubs there. There is the Atlanta Radio Club, which is based down in the city. That tends to be focused more around Georgia Tech and the Georgia Tech campus. They have an amateur radio station there at Georgia Tech. And then there's another club that's based up north of the city in Roswell, Georgia, and that's the North Fulton Amateur Radio Club. Now, they claim to have about 350 people. I've been to their meetings. I see about maybe 30 people show up, but they do have a large membership, and they do seem to do a lot of things. They're a fairly active club, but they're struggling, too. I've spoken with the president and vice president of that club, and I think they're struggling too to try to get people, you know, to be active and to participate in the club activities.
What's the potential market in that area in terms of the number of licensees that you could actually pull from?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, because I would say, Eric, you know, that even in our area where our club is located in you know, Cherokee County and Cobb County, which is adjacent to that area right there where we operate, you could easily have, you know, 300 or 400 hams. So, you know, you're right. It's like the majority of them do not really participate, and a lot of them maybe are not even active. You know, they may have gotten their technician class license but never really did anything with it, other reasons, just exited the hobby. So it's a big market, but I think one of the things that is different maybe in the Atlanta area than it might be in other parts of the country is that we're still getting an influx of new people here, where people are moving. You know, we're a destination. Atlanta is still a destination for a lot of folks moving from primarily northeast, but there are some moving even from the west. And so we're getting new people in all the time. And when they come in, that may be something that they look to see. Is there an amateur radio club? There is. Okay. And they show up. And we have that happen all the time. People just show up at one of our meetings.
The clubs we're talking about, at least the ones that you've mentioned, these are like general interest amateur radio clubs. They're not like a DX contesting club or something like that.
No, we do have a couple of those. There is a Southern, I think it's called South or Southern DX club. There are some of those specialty clubs that focus on just those things. But yeah, these are just the general clubs.
Do you see that there's an opportunity in a general club to actually, say, create departments or areas of specialty? Maybe that's more based on the kinds of members and how sophisticated they are.
Well, that does come down to one. You know, you're hitting on one of the things that I think that we realized and that we saw, that when you have a club, especially a general club, you need to figure out what the interests of that group are. And then you need to figure out, how am I going to meet the interests of that group? So we saw the fact that we did have some folks that were interested in, you know, kit building or home brewing kind of stuff. We found some that were interested in parks on the air. We had some folks that were interested, really primarily their reason for being in the club is for, you know, amateur radio emergency services type of thing. And so what we did is we created special interest groups inside the club to kind of foster those relationships as well as activities. The one that's probably been the most successful has really probably been the Parks on the Air group. There's about maybe 10 people in that organization, and they go around fairly regularly to the parks. And in fact, just recently, they've been doing some of these things that was just a personal challenge of trying to activate 10 parks in one day. They've done the 10 POTA park challenge,
where they will move from park to park, or they'll send out 10 different.
No, they actually move from park to park. So they'll go to a park, set up, they have to make 10 contacts, a minimum of 10 contacts to make the park qualified as being activated. So then they'll pack up everything, move on to the next park.
What a lot of fun. Mostly retired guys probably, or something like that.
Yeah. It's a whole day event, and they just have a blast doing it.
this POTA group, for example, do they maybe do a weekly in the park? Is it that frequent?
Seems to be a bit more ad hoc, a bit more ad hoc. And of course, in wintertime, it depends on weather a little bit too. But I would say, yeah, they do it pretty frequently in the summer. I would say it's, yeah, every week or two, they're definitely out doing something.
Now, are HOAs a challenge in the Atlanta area?
They're a challenge everywhere. I'm in an HOA, and yeah, they're a challenge everywhere. We do have a few members that I would say it's maybe even more challenging than some, but yes, they're a challenge. In my particular case, it's not so bad. I have my antenna in the attic, but I have a two-story house, and the back of my property kind of falls off pretty rapidly, and I actually do a pretty good job with the antenna that I've got in the attic. I've even worked some of these DX contests and you know, worked 43 countries and things like that off of this antenna. So it does work. You can do a lot of things.
Are the clubs considering, for example, maybe creating a shared remote station?
It has been something that's been brought up, and I really believe in the future this is going to be the way, because I think HOAs are not only the ones that are intrusive, but, you know, as members are getting older and maybe transitioning into, you know, senior living, that's probably even more restrictive, either senior living or if they have to go into, you know, some sort of assisted living, anything like that. You know, that just kind of destroys the hobby for them in a lot of ways. But if they had a remote station, right, that they could connect to, they could continue doing what they're doing. And I think that would be fantastic. We haven't gone down that path yet, but there's been some talk about it. And we've got a couple of members who actually have some property and, you know, ability to put up, you know, larger antennas and towers and things like that, that would be conducive to doing that.
Right. And you've got the legal entity in order to be able to manage that. Hams are living longer.
Yeah. And I think that that's going to be something that will be highly desirable if people can do that. But you bring up a good point about HOAs, because there are some people that are in, you know, in a situation with HOA, but where their property is located too, even if they put an antenna in the attic, it may not be that effective because of the geography around them.
Right. Or foil backing on the insulation and everything else.
Yeah, exactly. Or a metal roof. We have some homes with metal roofs. Yeah. All of those things are something that gets in the way.
I'm looking at your QRZ page, but I've also been looking in other places. You like to build. You still have a ham radio workbench. What's on the workbench right now?
Well, right now, I could, you know, for your audio or for your video, I can hold up something here. This is my latest concoction. This is actually a whisper transmitter. On the whisper transmitter, it has a GPS.
Is that your design?
Yes.
Oh, it's beautiful. So you're holding up an Arduino controller or something like that on one end?
That's correct. That's an Arduino controller. There's an OLED display. You've got a VCO, a 5153 VCO, and you got also a GPS receiver. Well, the GPS, because, you know, the way that Whisper works is you have to have a precise time base. Because Whisper gets transmitted on the top of the hour, and then every 2 minute segment, it has to be exactly within those segments, plus or minus a second or so. So you got to have some fairly accurate timing to do this. So a lot of the folks that have homebrewed these things have decided that GPS was an easy way to do it. You drop one of these GPS chips on there, and you get that.
And they're cheap now.
Yeah, you're perfect. I mean, you get the perfect time base, and it works great.
And what are your plans for Whisper? What do you think you're going to do? You're going to check antennas out, check HOA antennas out with Whisper?
Well, that's precisely what I do with Whisper, and this is what other people in the club want to do. There's a number of them that want to build this design. As soon as I'm done working out the bugs and finishing the firmware for it, we'll build a number of these. But that is a really useful thing in determining how well your antenna is operating and then understanding where it's going. So, for example, when I connect it to my antenna, I can see that I have a dead zone off to the southeast. And it's just because of the geography that's that direction from me. There's other houses and trees and other things that kind of attenuate the signal probably a little bit going that direction. But the antenna is just not very effective going that direction. But I can see that the antenna is incredibly useful going to the north, to the northeast, and to the northwest. And that is where I get most of my contacts.
So you can also see that if you make some just minor changes in the attic, how to affect that change.
Yeah, right. And that's what I think people need to understand. You know, when they put up an antenna, all antennas have got some sort of a compromise. So you just need to understand what is going on with it and how you might be able to change it.
I saw that the board is beautifully done. It's a surface mount technology.
Yes.
Are you using 1205 or is it even smaller than that? And do you actually, you lay the board out with some software?
I have some 0805s on here, which that'll challenge you to get, you know, 0805 size resistors and capacitors on there. But that's the smallest I can go. I can't see anything smaller than that.
So you're laying out the board yourself
mm-hmm.
with OrCAD or something like that?
I use KiCad, KiCad.
That's free?
It's free and it works great.
Are you a Linux user?
I am.
That's why you're using KiCad, perhaps?
Well, I use it both on Windows and Linux. It actually works pretty good on Windows, too. But yeah, it's probably better on Linux.
So you have the boards made. You buy the parts in some kind of a library.
Right.
From China.
Yep. The boards are made in China. And I buy the parts, you know, from various vendors. Mostly DigiKey or Mouser. Or it's guys like that because they cater to hobbyists and they'll sell you the parts, you know, even the stuff that's in reels, right? They'll clip off, you know, they'll clip off 50 parts off of a reel and send it to you. Whereas, you know, the larger supply, no, you got to buy the whole reel. No, I don't want the whole reel. I just want 15 parts.
So do you actually make a mask for it, or will you like use some soldering paste in order to tack everything on and then heat it in your toaster oven or something? Or how do you do that?
I use the soldering paste, which does actually work really well. But I do use a hot air soldering gun.
So you're blowing hot air.
Yeah.
So you're using the paste to hold the part in place, and then you're heating up the board and letting it set.
That's correct.
It's beautifully done.
Works well. Now, you know, of course, you got to think about this when you build the board, Eric, because, you know, you want to do those parts first. Yeah, because the other stuff is going to be in the way. You don't want to be melting, you know, other things that you're putting on the board. So you have to have a method of assembly when you go to do these things. And you put all these surface mount things on first so that they're not in the way. And then you can put in other things that might be more heat sensitive if you're putting sockets or other items on there that you don't want to melt.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. If you were manufacturing this board commercially, then it would probably be a quarter of the size that it is now. So the size that you have is designed for you to be able to work with it.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And I was also thinking about other people assembling it too. So that's what my thoughts were is when I made it, you know, space the stuff out far enough that, you know, somebody can with their big hands and tweezers can get in there and put these parts down on the board. Because, yes, you could make it a lot smaller if you really pack the stuff close together.
What other projects do you have right now?
I got a couple of other different ones I'm working on. You know, we have we have an event that's coming up here soon in April where we're going to be hosting an ARIS event. So the local elementary school is going to be, was chosen as one of the sites to do a contact with the space station. So I'm helping the teacher there with a couple of different projects for the students. And one of the things that we're going to be doing is building some antennas for fox hunting. So that's something that, she wanted the students to experience was, you know, how to do something like fox hunting.
So those fox hunting antennas would have to have simple receivers on them?
We'll just be using, you know, HTs and fox. The fox will be, you know, 144 megahertz range.
Yeah, you certainly couldn't build a receiver cheaper than you can buy a Baofeng from Amazon, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, you can't find anything cheaper than that. So that's what we're going to use. And we're building a simple loop antenna. I don't have one handy here I can show you, but I'm building a simple loop antenna that the kids can hold. And, you know, as they point different directions, they can determine which direction the signal's coming from.
That sounds like a great activity. I also see that you're involved with, because it's on your website, Skywarn.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about what Skywarn is and how you participate?
Well, it's another thing for clubs to get involved in, and that's that also kind of ties back into the question about clubs and club activity. Is that one of the things that we do is to support the local EOC, that's the Emergency Operations Center here in Cherokee County. So our ARIES team actually has an amateur radio station in the EOC. And so when things like big weather events are coming by, what we do is we activate our team of ARIES folks and we act as a Skywarn group to kind of watch what's happening for what they call truth on the ground weather reporting. So what happens with the National Weather Service is they can see things on radar and they can, you know, get an idea what storms might be doing, but they have no ground truth of what is actually happening out there. So what we do is our members are reporting in to the EOC, giving ground truth information about trees down and, you know, the intensity of wind and all those steps, whether or not there's hail. And then we collect that information and we radio that to the National Weather Service in Peachtree City, Atlanta. So that's what the group is for, is a number of the amateur radio clubs are involved in Skywarn, and it's a great, great activity to engage members in. But it's also a big service to the National Weather Service to know what is actually happening on the ground.
I somehow thought that Skywarn was you chasing hurricanes across or tornadoes across the plains.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's not.
Yeah, it's really a good thing. And we have a training. There is a training for it that, you know, teach people how to report the stuff. Because obviously, you know, hey, it's raining over here. Yeah, okay, we know it's raining over there. But is the wind blowing and do you have hail? Or, you know, how hard is it raining? So, you know, we try to educate people on how would you report the weather information so that we're not just reporting extraneous stuff, that we're getting good information and then being able to send that back to the weather service.
So do Skywarn members then become interested in maybe having their own weather station so they can actually talk about wind speed and moisture and things like that?
Some of them do. I would say, yeah, some do. I don't know how many of those members, it's three or four of them that are part of Skywarn do have a weather station. Interestingly enough, I think this was about a year ago, one of the members was reported a tornado that came right over the top of their property. So he was standing outside, which he probably shouldn't have been, and the tornado went right over the top of his head. And, you know, Weather Service knew that there was something going on that they hadn't really quite confirmed what was happening, but he actually saw the tornadic activity right over the top of his property.
Fortunately, he did not end up in Oz.
Right, exactly. Yes. But, you know, it's stuff like that. We don't encourage people to go chase storms or do anything like that, but we do encourage them to report what ground activity they do see, and it's a big service.
What excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now?
Wow. You know, there's so much stuff going on, and I think that this is something that maybe people new to amateur radio don't realize, but there is just so much stuff going on. one of the things that excites me still about it is QRP stuff. I'm still always amazed what QRP can do. And for those who don't know QRP, that means low power. So you've got a lot of rigs now on the market. I happen to have one that's a commercial rig. I have an ICOM 705, which puts out 5 watts on its internal battery and 10 watts if you connect external battery. And I use that for parks on the air. So I'll go out, you know, set that radio up on a picnic table, connect it to a vertical antenna, and I'm talking to people all over the country on 10 watts and sometimes even DX. So it's always amazing what QRP can do.
And what operating mode are you using with the 705?
Mostly sideband, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah.
The sunspot cycle is really working right now.
Exactly. So it's a good time to be doing QRP right now. We do have some members that do primarily CW, Morse code, when they're doing parks on the air. But a lot of us still like voice mode. We like sideband and like talking to people. So there's a lot of the activity that's on parks on the air is sideband.
What's the radio behind your head there?
I've got a couple of different radios. I've got an ICOM 7300, although I've got one behind me here. That's an HT. Let's see, that's the radiology. This one's a nice little radio. This particular one is a very nice little radio. This is the radiodity, and it's the GS5B. What's nice about this radio for field work is that it's not only programmable through a USB connector, but it's also something where you can add a new frequency using your cell phone.
Because it's a Bluetooth interface or something like that?
It's a Bluetooth interface, so you can actually load in new frequencies from your phone.
And what are the current rigs? You mentioned that you've got the IC705 that you take out in the field, but what do you have on your ham shack?
Yeah, my regular rig that I use every day, almost every day, is my ICOM, also 7300. Absolutely great rig. I think you have one of those as well, don't you?
I have one. It was a meter from me sitting here.
Yeah, there you go. So it's an absolutely...
It's amazing.
Amazing radio. And, you know, I love it. I think it does extremely well. The 705 is really kind of a twin to it. It does a lot of the same things. But, of course, the portability of that is much better.
Plus, it operates all the modes.
Yeah.
VHF, UHF. I'm understanding that it's now making an ideal baseband radio for people that are doing, say, 10 gigahertz or, you know, microwave.
That's right. I haven't gotten into that. Interesting enough, you know, we don't have anybody in the club that's really gotten into that either. I think people who maybe did some of that stuff is their career tend to experiment more, maybe more with that. It's a little bit tricky to get into, and it's a whole other field of knowledge all by itself.
It seems to me you have to have some access to some test equipment.
Yeah, you definitely do, and you definitely have to have some knowledge. It's getting closer to plumbing than, right?
Yeah, it may be.
So, but anyway, those are things that I think that excite me. I think other communications methods. There's a lot of new activity going on. I mean, there's some folks now that are experimenting with basically digital voice on HF.
Yes, quite amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an area we're going to see. There's also a lot of that being done right now too on VHF, UHF with programs like Vera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Vera FM. There's a Vera HF. All these digital protocols, I think, are pretty fascinating stuff. And again, these are things that people can dig into and learn and find out about.
Do you have advice that you would give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Well, the number one thing I would always tell someone, maybe even like myself, coming back into the hobby is try to find a club, because I think that is the only way you're going to really figure out how to get active again. If you try to figure it out on your own, you might be able to get there. I mean, let's face it, there's a ton of YouTube videos. There's all this, you know, articles of knowledge and even the stuff that you publish, Eric, and all of that stuff is all great. But I think those are things that are more suited for someone who's already engaged. And so I think trying to figure out how to get engaged again is tricky, and that's why I say you got to find a club. And one of my favorite quotes is this Ben Franklin quote. I don't know if you've ever heard this quote before, but it says, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn."
I haven't heard that, but I'm going to put it in the show notes page.
Yeah, it's an involvement, and that's what I tell people when they come to the club. What are you getting out of the club? What you're going to get is you're going to learn, you're going to build some skills, and you're going to be involved. If you get involved, you'll learn. If you learn, then you're going to be a better ham radio operator. So that's the, I think the pathway in is you got to learn by doing, you know, find a club, get active, and just go in, jump in with both feet.
Well, I see when I'm mentoring somebody right now, as people know, I'm mentoring a 9-year-old, knowing how to even like hold the soldering iron.
Yeah.
You can't beat having a mentor.
That's right.
So if you can use the club as a way to find the guy or gal that has the expertise that you want, or can kind of steer you away from, you know, maybe something that will frustrate you early on, but might be very satisfying once you have a year or two of experience under your belt, I think that's a key to success.
Well, I think the, you know, the people that have joined the club and, you know, say they've been there now a year, that's one of the things they usually come back and say is that, you know what, you helped me figure out how to do this. You figured out, I've learned, you know, from others how to operate a radio, how to, what, you know, what's the protocol, how to, you know, I don't have mic fright anymore. I can pick up the microphone and make a call and I feel good about it. So it's really just the learn by doing thing. But I think having somebody by your side, as you say, a mentor or a tutor to help you through the process is invaluable.
So I'm going to ask you, Martin, because I asked somebody this in an earlier podcast. Do you think that elderly hams or older hams who are active in ham radio, do you think they live longer?
I think people who have activities that interest them live longer. So ham radio would be one of them. I definitely think so. I mean, I think that people who have, you know, any kind of a hobby that can really cause them to think and to use their hands and to gain their interest and keep them learning. That's the important thing. Keep them learning, I think, will extend your life.
Also, maybe the social side, where the human connections that ham radio offers.
Absolutely. And we see that in the club, because I think that, you know, we have some older, you know, I'm older, but even older than me, okay, that show up for the club. And I think this is their only activity every month. They look so forward to coming to the club meeting for that reason, Eric. You know, they want to see the people. They want to talk to people. You know, they want to interact, because maybe they don't get so much of that every day.
Does your club have a regular, maybe daily or weekly net on the repeater or something like that?
We do. Mm-hmm. We have a weekly net on Thursday nights, and we typically get about between 30 and 40 check-ins on a Thursday night, which is, you might say, well, you know, you got 130 members. Yeah, but that's actually pretty good.
Thursday night is the night out, maybe. Well, maybe it's not. For us, it's the night out, but.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, we conflict, obviously, with other personal things. And, you know, if you're available, check in. If you're not, you know, that's okay, too.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's a pretty good number, as we found out.
Martin, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. I know we touched on just a few things, but I think all of those things were interesting and will interest the listeners as well. So with that, I want to thank you and wish you 73.
Yeah, thank you again, Eric. I appreciate it very much and love the podcast and hope you can continue for a long time. 73.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Martin. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in KB4MG in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the sponsor transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.